You're listening to an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
Time to compare and maybe contrast the experiences of going through education, employment and life for two blind people 50 years apart now here on RNIB Connect Radio, following on from a recent column by the Right Honourable Lord Blunkett in the Yorkshire Post, where he talks openly about the challenges of being blind, something that he rarely talks about. Holly Tuke, RNIB's social media manager, who has been blind since birth and went through education maybe 50 years after Lord Blunkett, has written a follow-up article in the Yorkshire Post talking about some of the challenges she has had to face and overcome in her life too. I'm delighted to say that both Lord Blunkett and Holly join me now to talk about some of those challenges they have both had to face and also to reflect on their lives as two blind people 50 years apart. David and Holly, it's great to have you both with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Very pleased to be with you and to be able to speak with Holly and share experiences.
Likewise, it's great to be here and speak to David and share experiences as well.
Well, before I ask you both to give me a bit of an overview of the time for you both going through education as a blind person, David, what prompted you to write this article about some of those challenges that you have faced as a blind person? Because I know this is a subject that you maybe don't like to dwell on too much.
Well, a light-hearted reason was because I was sick of writing about politics and the readership was sick of reading about politics when it was a holiday month. So I thought, what shall I do for August that's a little bit different? Shall I reflect on some of the experiences, only some, in a 900-word article, about growing up, about getting a job, about the challenges, particularly of written material and time management, and we'll presumably be coming to that. And so I thought, well, let's for a change do it. And thanks to Holly, that stimulated a further debate, which I think will be very informative for the public.
So, David, do tell me what it was like for you as a young blind person going through primary, secondary, and then into further education.
Well, I was in formal schooling in the 1950s and early 60s. It was pretty gruesome because there was no going round the corner to the local school and getting support. This was about residential provision, in my case, from the age of four, which I've always said was quite an emotional challenge, to put it mildly. I think it took me a long time to get over that because you were away from your family, you were away from your peer group where you were living in the community, and you had to fend for yourself. The plus of it was to make me much more resilient. I think it prepared me for some of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune in politics, but it was at a price. And I had to do my qualifications in a very odd way because the school I went to, which was the Royal National College, it was at Shrewsbury at the time. It's now post 16 college at Hereford, but it was 12 to 19 at the time. They didn't do external, what was then in those days, O level and A level. And it was a bizarre situation given that the head had a PhD and had his headship because he'd got the qualifications. But to cut a long story short, some of us, a little small group of us, went down to the local technical college in the evening, persuaded the school to do a couple of the O-levels as part of the commercial course that we were doing, learning typing and shorthand, or some of our colleagues were doing music and piano tuning. And when I returned to Sheffield and got a job, I carried on going on day release from work, going in the evenings, and got the A-levels and the business qualification to get into university. So it was a long haul. It took me 6 years before I actually managed to get into university. But it was a seminal experience, and it drove me to later being able to do something as Education and Employment Secretary about changing the life chances of young people as a whole.
And Holly, does any of what David's just said ring true to you? And do tell me a little bit about your own journey going through education as a blind person, maybe 50 years after David.
Yeah, of course. So for me, I would say in some ways there are similarities. So when David speaks about, you know, learning things like learning to type, and yeah, for me, that was embedded from a very young age. I'd probably say five or six, if I'm correct. And yeah, it's interesting to hear that, you know, when we look back how technology has changed our education, And I think for me, when David there spoke about how special schools and colleges have made more resilience, and that is a lot more palpable when you think about either mainstream or a specialist college, I'd say for me, I went through mainstream education all the way through and was really lucky to have gone to a primary school that was kind of on my doorstep, really. It was walking distance, and then secondary school again was similar. But for me, it made me more resilient because I was the only blind child in both primary and secondary. On the other hand, though, it meant a lot of fighting for support that I and my parents knew I was entitled to. And so there probably in many years of my education wasn't a month where my parents didn't go into school and fight for the support that I needed or was entitled to, because they knew it was my right and they wanted to ensure that I could get that education. And then I guess in comparison to that, when I moved on to further education, I decided to stay in mainstream and do my A levels and then go on to university. So I stayed at the same secondary school to do that. But now if I look back, I think I probably would have gone to the Royal National College of the Blind, RNC, if I'd have had the chance to do that. I think if I could do it differently, I would do that, because I would say at that moment in time, they set you up a bit more for university, at least they do now. And, you know, things like independent living skills, helping you with employment or anything like that specifically for blind and partially sighted people is embedded into their curriculum. Whereas in mainstream, I kind of was going along, me and my family are trying to figure it out by ourselves, and I had great support from teaching assistants, but it was the attitudes of teachers who thought I couldn't do something, who thought that accessibility wasn't a priority. And yeah, I think for me, that's what I would do differently. So it's really interesting to hear a comparison of experiences there.
And Holly, what you're describing is now part of a major national debate about how we support people who have special educational needs, either in mainstream or in specialist facilities or a mixture of the two, and the massive challenge that parents and young people have in getting the entitlement to the support. So there's a debate starting. There's going to be a policy white paper. There's going to be a long debate about how we try and get this right, because you're going back a few years now, not as much as me, but the debate continues and the pressures continue. And I just wondered whether you felt that the balance of having the support that the RNC now gives, and by the way, it's a very different institution to the one I went to. They do offer both professional but also academic qualifications. Whether you think that the balance that you had was wrong, because I always wanted to go to mainstream, and I only ended up in mainstream when I got to further education, where I went on day release or the evening class.
Yeah, I would say that for me, mainstream education felt right up until my A-levels. And that's when I would have done things differently. I definitely don't regret going through mainstream education. I think it taught me a lot and made me so much more resilient. It made me a little bit more kind of aware to the misconceptions that people put on us as blind people. But yeah, if I could do A-levels again, I would do them at somewhere like RNC for sure.
Holly, I know when you were growing up, David was maybe that sort of blind person role model that was there in your life. And I suppose seeing David out there working and playing his part in society and certainly fighting his corner from the benches of the House of Commons too, how important was it to have somebody like David and other people in the media and TV when you were going for education?
It was so important. When you're surrounded by professionals who might tell you you can't do something or it's going to be so much harder, life isn't going to be accessible and things will be hard for you, you start to believe that. And although your family and friends tell you the opposite and that you can do things, you know, having education professionals say, well, it's going to be harder and you need to do this, you need to do that, and they kind of are looking at it at a bit more of a tainted view. Having people like David in the media or in the limelight, showing not only us, but society that, you know what, I'm out here living my life and I can do exactly what I want to do with whatever reasonable adjustments it might be that work for me. It's so important because it gives us that belief and it tells us, yes, you can do anything you want to. You can aim for that career, even though you are blind, and it doesn't necessarily matter. So yeah, for me, I think it's really important.
You've made me feel very humble, and I'm glad. It's really rewarding for me to hear you say so, because I've often thought of all the policy things I got involved in over the years, probably being out there saying to employers, please give a blind person the chance of an interview. Please don't make your own assumptions. I've often thought that that was probably the best thing I've been able to do, although I'm afraid it's not changed very much, the percentage of blind adults of working age who are in a job. So it may have made individually a difference. I'm not sure I've shifted the dial sufficiently. I'm minded of a poem by William Blake called London, where he talks about mind-forged manacles. And I think we're surrounded by people who are trying to put us in mind-forged manacles, because they're seeing it from their point of view and their attitude can affect what you can do. So I think it's quite profound, actually, what you said, Holly, about other people's view of what's possible. I mean, I always laugh and say, you know, that there are realistic boundaries. We're not going to try and be a bus driver or a pilot, although in years to come, it looks as if we might be able to, except I wouldn't travel in the bus, and I certainly wouldn't travel in an aircraft piloted by a blind person.
And there are some common themes which I think come through both of your articles. And one thing which I think is something that we've all had to do through both education and even through our work too, is that we all have to probably spend a bit more time going through written material, whether that might be books and papers when we're studying, or it might just be all those amounts of documents that we have to read for work, or maybe the extra time that it takes us to do a bit of research. And I wondered for you both, you know, do you feel that, you know, that is something that you've both had to do? And also the impact on social life and everything else? Because I know, David, you say that you only visited the many bars and pubs around the Houses of Parliament maybe once or twice during your time as an MP and a frontbench minister.
Yeah, I think about half a dozen times in the 28 years I was in the Commons. And I tried to recall whether I'd been in one of the bars in the 10 years I've been in the House of Lords. I think not, mainly because time management is pretty crucial if you can't see. And what you're doing in your own personal time has to be balanced by the pressures of reading material. I think you'll be able to describe better, Holly, but I think because you're good at social media and using the tech, you'll be able to move through things faster. On the other hand, you're inundated with emails. And I'm very fortunate. I can afford, using the daily allowance that I get for going into the House of Lords, to employ somebody to sift this, because there's a lot of rubbish. I fear that if I became a member of the Commons now, without really big support, I would have gone under, because it was challenging enough to deal with the correspondence, with the policy papers, journals, etc. Now you're inundated, aren't you, Holly, with material?
Yeah, definitely. I would say for me, during my time in education, things like Braille note takers and Braille displays were becoming increasingly popular. Unfortunately, that's not something me or my family were able to get me at the time. And yeah, it wasn't able to be funded. When I now look back at that time, having a big Perkins Brailler and a laptop and all of the materials in paper format in folders and folders, I mean, I could probably have covered a full room, if not more, with GCSE and A-level revision. And then when I think now, I've got a laptop, a mobile phone, access to Braille whenever I need it, it just makes such a huge difference. Because like you say, David, we're so used to being good at time management. We're natural problem solvers that, yeah, this tech, it just transforms our lives and makes those things so much easier.
I'm smiling because you can do it. I'm clearly very much on top of it. And it's not just age in my case. It's a psychological block. I have to force myself to get up to date with some of the technology, even using a digital recorder that can send material down the line from my home in Sheffield to London. It took ages to be persuaded to even use that. So I'm afraid I'm a dinosaur.
And another theme was around how sighted people see us and that constant thing of having to keep on explaining to people about what we can do and how we've just maybe some minor adjustments or a little bit of help, we can all do anything. Holly, as social media manager here at the RNIB, do you think that the rise of social media and with yourself and other disabled people out there blogging and sharing your lives through Instagram, TikTok and other social media platforms has helped to change people's perceptions and opinions around sight loss?
I definitely think it is having an impact. So the algorithms and all of that is feeding people now videos or articles from blind and visually impaired people who are choosing to share their lives online. And granted, it's not for everyone, but for those of us who do, people are coming across that. And social media has become a place of education for sure. So being a part of RNIB's social media team for me is incredible because I get to do that every single day. And the role of our social media team, if I could probably sum it up in a short summary, it would be that we focus on accessible social media, so encouraging people to make their content accessible, educating others, like you say, Toby. But then from the flip side of that, it's calling out ableism and when things aren't okay so that we can try and help change society and help change those narratives and people's perceptions that they might have of people who are blind. So for all of the internet's faults, it makes such a difference in that it can be used in a good way to be a form of education.
Let me play you a compliment back. You are undoubtedly a role model for those coming up behind you. No question about that. Not only in terms of your own presentation and your ability to use the equipment so brilliantly, but also to encourage others to take part, because that's part of your job. And I wondered whether you were able to help parents, because you mentioned your parents fighting. My mum in particular had no idea what a blind child's future was going to be all those years ago and was in terrific distress. So helping parents as well as the youngster to understand the possibilities and to perhaps relate to each other a bit, give each other some peer-to-peer support, I think that's quite important. Are you able to do that a bit as well, Holly?
Oh, firstly, thank you so much. Yeah, that really means a lot. Yeah. I'd say one part of my role that is my favourite, not only just in terms of my work at RNIB, but my advocacy outside through my own blog, is hearing from not only people who are blind or visually impaired, but parents as well. And they all get in touch and say, through an RNIB lens of, I'm looking for support. And it feels so reassuring to reply as a blind person, and they don't necessarily know I'm blind, but say, you know what, we're here for you, and here's where you can get support. And then also for my work outside of RNIB, I do have parents contact me and say, oh, I've read your post and can I ask a few follow-up questions? So for me, yeah, that is really important because I can hopefully give them that reassurance that their child is going to be okay. And of course, there will be difficult times, but from that, their child is probably going to thrive and, you know, do all the things that they want to do. And yeah, I think it's just having that reassurance and connection. So I do hope that I do that in some way.
Toby, can I ask just one other question? I'm being intrusive here, so you get a grip of me. But I just wondered, Holly, how responsive are the tech providers? Because it annoys me that they don't think through in advance what might be just a small change for them, but quite a big improvement for us.
Yeah, completely. It's a real mixed bag. So some are really responsive. And when we think about, say, social media specifically, some have accessibility teams who look into making their platform most accessible and implementing accessibility features for blind, visually impaired or disabled users, but then others don't. And then when it comes to tech more widely, you only have to look at companies like Microsoft, who are leading the way, and then others, you know, don't know about accessibility and maybe don't have an accessible website for people to do online shopping, for example. So yeah, it's a real mixed experience.
And one thing which I don't think has changed in maybe the last 20, 40 or even 50 years is the fact that only one in four visually impaired people of working age is in employment. What do you both think could be done, and maybe one or two things that could be done to change that employment stat around for blind and partially sighted people? And maybe you, David, first.
Well, we've talked about attitude changes. Holly's really demonstrated that excellently. So we've just got to get that message through. Secondly, we've also got to inform what is available. I mean, I fought like hell to ensure that access to work facility was expanded. I still think we're missing a major trick. I think from the moment a young person gets an EHCP or whatever it's going to be called in the future, the right to a package of measures and support, that should carry automatically through the Disabled Students Allowance into access to work. And there should be a seamless approach to providing equipment as well as other supportive measures so that when someone goes for a job, they're able to tell the employer what's available in advance rather than seeking the job and then finding themselves without the adaptations or the equipment and then floundering, because there's nothing worse than the message that gets sent out. I found this when I went into the Commons in 87. It took the best part of a year to persuade them to give me the package of measures that allowed me to work on equal terms. And if I'd gone under, the message that would have sent to everyone else would have been devastating. So I think we need a much more comprehensive approach, which encompasses careers, training. The facility should always be available in education and training, and not just when you get a job. And I don't know whether you found access to work helpful yourself, Holly, but it needs to be much more seamless than it is at the moment.
Yeah, I would agree with everything that you've said there, David. In terms of access to work, it definitely does need to be more seamless. I've been on the receiving end of really positive experiences, but then also the experiences of waiting and how that can have an impact. I'd say for me, I'd echo everything David said there. Just to add to that, I think one thing when we think about employing someone who is blind or visually impaired, give them a chance. It starts right from the application stage, if not before. So make your recruitment accessible, because we can't apply if the recruitment process isn't accessible. And if employers do then get an application from someone who is blind, for example, and they think they meet the job spec, then give them an interview, because you want to give someone a chance to not only show them what they can do, but just for you to get to know them and see what they're capable of, because there's so many misconceptions out there that we aren't capable, and we actually are, and we can bring so much to an organisation. And once you've done that, I think it's just about knowing that support is available. Although access to work certainly isn't a seamless process, and there's so much work being done to undo that and make it better, it's about having conversations with hopefully the person who is blind or partially sighted who gets the role, and knowing what support they need, because you can have those conversations and it isn't as scary as you think it might be.
And I think that with all the difficulties of the welfare to work debate and the debacle over the piece of legislation, one bit that has survived is the notion that someone could take a job, experience the job, and if it didn't work out, they'd be entitled to go back onto the original benefits rather than losing out and having to start all over again. And I think it's really important we hang on to that bit of the agenda as well, because then both the individual and the employer might be prepared to take a risk.
Finally, what would you both like people to come away with from reading your articles in the Yorkshire Post? And maybe to you, David, first.
Well, let me just be very complimentary to get across the message that you've got younger people like Holly who are forging new ground, hopefully building a bit on the spade work that I've done over the years, and that they are demonstrating on a daily basis the grasp of what's available now through new technology and the equality that that brings. And I'm very proud that we've both been able to share experiences in our regional newspaper.
I would say for me, having people like David who are setting that example and putting the groundwork in for us to then hopefully go and cement that is, yeah, it's a real asset to everything that the people before us have done. And then from that, I'd say everyone has a role to play. So RNIB is making huge strides in creating change, but we need everyone to join us on that. You know, the RNIB, all the other sightless organisations, and blind and partially sighted people can't do it alone. We need everyone to be on board and create that society that we so long hope for.
Absolutely. The absolutely crucial message, Toby, is this is about us all. It's a challenge, everyone. And that's why over the years I've said disability isn't solely about disabled people. It's about elected members at local authority level, at in these days, the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Assembly, and in our Westminster Parliament. It's everybody's business, not just ours. And if we get that message across, we might change the world still further.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much indeed, David and Holly, for taking the time to chat with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and giving an insight into both your lives as blind people, maybe 50 years apart, but possibly quite similar in many ways. Thank you both.
Thank you, and go well.
Thank you.
For more interviews, features and shows, go to your favourite podcast provider and search for RNIB Connect Radio.